Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Disruptive Business, celebrating those who change the game.
Disruptive Business features cutting-edge organizations and the innovative leaders who guide them. Today's show is brought to you by Minerva Planning Group. I'm Dana Barrett, and of course, joining me in the studio is the host of this fabulous show, Micah Porter. Hello.
Good morning, Dana. How are you?
I'm maybe a little overcaffeinated. How are you?
I'm well. I stuck to my one cup of coffee, so I feel like I can keep things on track this morning.
All right. Well, I'm going to rely on you because this doesn't happen often because I usually monitor my coffee, but I'm a little jittery, actually. So maybe it's these fabulous guests that we have in the studio that are making me nervous with all of their disruption in the business marketplace.
Just deep breaths and you'll be fine.
Okay. In the studio today, we have three wonderful guests, all with somewhat challenging names. So here we go. Radhika. There we go.
That's good enough.
I told you it was caffeine. Radhika Subramanian.
That's funny.
No? Yeah?
Try again.
I would go with Subramanian.
I told you Micah should have done this because I had too much coffee. But the company is MCN Corporation, right? Did
Fantastic.
I get that right? All right.
Absolutely.
Who won the bet on which name I was going to blow? We'll see if I blow more than one.
You haven't gotten through it yet.
All right. We also have Kobe Margolin.
Okay.
Margolin.
Radhika won.
Clinigence is the name of his company, and Jesse Lindsley from Thrust Interactive.
Perfect.
Okay. So I knew I was going to blow it, so I figured I'd go with the hardest one first.
And usually a good approach.
We just get that out of the way. So we know we all relaxed, and if anybody was nervous now, they won't be, because if I'm screwing up, it's okay for you guys to screw up.
It's a great way to begin, Dave.
That's right. So you guys all have some interesting businesses, and I think we want to sort of talk to each of you individually. So, Michael, why don't you get us started?
Sure. I thought, Radhika, since you're directly to my left, I thought we would start with you. I know MCN focuses on big data. So why don't you tell us a bit about big data and what the challenges are associated with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Michael. And by the way, thanks so much for having me on this show. This is such a fabulous opportunity, and I'm really excited about this.
Well, we're glad you could make it.
Well, thanks. So, you know, let's take a step back and kind of understand big data, right? I mean, it's such a hot topic today. Everybody's talking about it. But data is not new. Data's been around for a long time. And we have been collecting, and organizations have been collecting data in small silos, in little organizations. What we have started to realize over time and faster is that, geez, if we bring this data together across different silos, there is so much more insight in them. Like, for example, here's the customer data, here's their stuff that we sold them, here's where they live, here's what the weather looks like, here's what they're saying on social media. Let's bring it all together, and wow, we would actually know so much more about it, right? So big data actually is breaking these stovepipes or silos, bringing the data together across these silos, and what you end up with is, you know, while it's called big data, it's really deep data. And what I mean by that is there are lots and lots of variables or lots and lots of columns in the data, right? So that's really the definition of big data. It's data from many different places coming together because they're bringing different dimensions to the problem.
From your perspective, you talk about bringing the data together from multiple silos. Is the bigger challenge for most large corporations, and I assume large corporations tend to be your client base?
Large corporations and the Intel community,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. When you're bringing the data together from multiple silos, is the challenge bringing the data together from those silos? Is it analyzing the data, or is it both? What's harder for your clients typically?
That's a really good question. So there are two sides to data. One is storing it. The other is analyzing it. Storage, we are really good at storage, right? And in fact, it's because storage is so cheap that we have so much data.
Right.
Right? It's the analyzing that's so difficult. And it's not the data that's important. It's the insight that's important, right? If we never had to store the data and somebody just handed you the insight, wouldn't you be happy?
Sure.
So it's really about the analysis.
Well, talk to me a little bit about the analytics and what that involves.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, remember, we just talked about the fact that, big data is really data coming from different silos and the fact that it's so deep and it has so many variables. So, as people are looking at this, the typical mindset is, geez, we've been doing search. Let's try to do data mining into it. Let's go and start, with a shovel, start digging into it. You cannot dig your way out of this. So there is a paradigm shift that's happening in the market, which is the data needs to come back and speak to you. It's almost like, imagine that this were a military operation and you had a helicopter that you could actually fly over the zone and very quickly say, oh, the mountains are there, the lakes are over there. I mean, this is kind of the landscape. We need powerful analytics that can do that with data, that can quickly digest the data, crunch it, come back to the user and say, this is what your data is saying to you. That's the huge paradigm shift that's happening in the market. And that's what companies are looking for, right? So we were with a really large organization yesterday, and they have started this, what they're calling the data lake, because it's big, it's deep. And one of the execs literally asked me, he said, Radhika, I'm really worried. Will we get to the insight in time? Or are we collecting all of this and we'll never really find the gold in the data?
It's interesting that you mentioned the need for timely analysis of the data. I think it was 2 weeks ago we had Don Turner on, the CEO of Velocity. And he takes AI algorithms and overlays them onto big data. And the example that he gave was if you're a commander that's monitoring an operation and knowing what's going on in 500 different chat rooms or 500 different data sources and knowing when to pull the plug on the operation, for example. So I think timeliness is something that's often overlooked when it comes to data analytics. And we haven't had the processing power, I'm assuming, until very recently to be able to do really timely analysis of big data.
You're absolutely right. It's all about time. There was this wonderful quote I heard, which is like time is life, right? If you don't get the insight in time, it's useless. So, I mean, let's think about this. Like now we know about box cutters, but it's too late, right? Mm. I mean, it always seems like we know about the financial crisis and all the subprime mortgages, but the insight was in the data. I mean, if you took the financial sector data and you actually did analysis, any really fantastic, trending algorithm would have showed you that, wait, the subprime loans are just going through the roof.
Right.
Right? But we didn't have that processing power and that intelligence, and we didn't hit it in time.
But
so we're always coming after the fact.
I think that's a really important point, because when you talk about big data, one of the things that's interesting to me is we've always had it, right? We've been accumulating this data for a long time. But do your customers actually know what they need to get out of it? Because if we had known to look for an economic crisis, perhaps we could have done so. But so if I'm a company and I am moving forward and I think I know that I need to gather these pieces of information from my data, maybe there's things I don't even know that I need. Is there a way to sort of facilitate their decision making?
Dana, that's a beautiful question. I almost feel like I set you up for it. I mean, it's fantastic. No, you don't know what you're looking for. That's the true pain of big data.
Yeah.
So why is big data being created? Big data is being created because organizations know that, hey, all these different variables, there must be insight there. But what you want the analytics to do, kind of like the example I told you, if you had a little plane going over a landscape saying, look, here are the mountains and here's the lake, you want the analytics to surface that insight for you and these are questions that you would have never asked.
Right.
So it's almost like the real problem with big data is hypothesis generation. It's what is the question I should be asking? That's where we are today.
Well, what sectors tend to benefit from what you do, and who are some of your key customers?
Okay, so the sectors that benefit are ones where the value is the greatest, right? I mean, just before when we were talking, you talked about healthcare. Healthcare really, really important because this is about saving lives. When you do clinical trials and you don't have the right hypothesis, if the data comes back and says, geez, guys, it's actually the lactose intolerant people who are actually interacting with this drug, it's huge. You wouldn't have even known to ask it. Financial sector, really, really big, right? So in the data where you have the transaction types, you've got all kinds of insights in terms of where's the money laundering happening? Where's the fraud happening? And those patterns then connect to things like the intel community, to security. So there's another big sector. So the applications are fairly broad and wide, but I think those are kind of probably the top three, which is intel, banking, and healthcare.
Right, right. Okay, all right. Well, can you give some examples of what you've done for some of your clients?
Absolutely. So I'm going to talk to you about one that's really fantastic, and this is with a law enforcement police department. So they've got data coming at them in real time with geolocation, with what's being said. It's coming from open source. And, you know, just as Dana said, you know, they didn't know what to ask. But here, the patterns and trends are emerging that says, hey, there's a group of people, and this is actually gang members, they're starting to fly the red, white, and blue flag. What's going on? And then they realize that it was the merger of two gangs, the Bloods and the Crips, right? It was the red, white, and blue. And so they were ahead of what was happening. That is really the magic of big data. It's having the analysis automatically be done and have it surface the insight for you.
Can we dig just a bit more into that example? As a layperson, my question would be, what is the data set you're working with, and how do you pull something like that out? I mean, and when I say layperson, I mean layperson. I'm thinking of an Excel spreadsheet when I think of data, and you know, so clearly that's not what you're working with. So how do your algorithms work through that? What does that process look like?
Okay, so that's a really good question. So when you think about data, there are two kinds of data, right? One is the static data that companies are just throwing into big data marts. The other kind of data where there's a lot more intelligence is the one that's moving. And the fastest moving data is actually social media and open source. So what we've got is this huge pipe that's actually collecting open source data that's coming from Twitter, from blogs, from chat rooms. All of that gets funneled in. And in that, of course, you've got the conversations and the text of what people are saying. You've got metadata that's related to the location of where they are. You do a pattern detection around it. And essentially what surfaces is something that looks like, hey, there's a group of people here who are talking about blah. It could be about the fact that, you know, Obama won, you know, the re-election. There's another group of people over here who are talking about a huge sale that's happening in Macy's. And there's another group of people here who are talking about the red, white, and blue flag. What's happening over there? You zoom in and boo, there you've got this merger.
So it's really directive. You know, the big data is directive. And then you can bring human intelligence to bear once you've identified a pattern.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Excellent. Well, you know, it sounds as if MCN is disruptive in the marketplace, but being an entrepreneur is typically disruptive in one's own life as well because you give so much of yourself to what you're doing. How have you managed the disruption in your own life from being an entrepreneur?
That's really funny. You know, somebody actually asked me, they said, you know, Radhika, what kind of balance do you have in your life? And I had to start laughing. I was like, you know, balance and me, or you know, entrepreneurs and balance, exactly, right? I mean, it's like, I don't even know what balance really means. But, you know, entrepreneurship and innovation is disruptive. It's fundamentally disruptive. And I think entrepreneurs, I mean, you know, and I think these guys would agree with me. I mean, we kind of thrive on that almost. And the beauty of it is you're in the front wave of change and innovation, and you have to keep up with all of that, you know, that's going on. So what that does is, you know, I typically find myself reading 3, 4, 5 books at the same time. Rarely do I sit down with one book, you know, end to end. It's almost like it forces me to be so ADD. I, you know, it's kind of becomes my second nature. And I think that's kind of how it disrupts my kind of regular life.
You learn to deal with all of the inputs and all of the interests and just roll with it.
Exactly.
And don't you feel like at some level, if you're passionate about what you're doing, which clearly I can tell that you are when you start talking about this stuff, it doesn't really feel like work. I know when I'm working on projects that I'm passionate about, I'm talking about it at 10 o'clock at night to my family, who's like, will you please shut up already? But I really want to talk about it because I'm excited about it. So it's not about finding that balance. It's actually about trying to like actually make room to get an ice cream cone with the family every once in a while, because I really want to talk about what I'm passionate. I'm having a good time.
Dana, you're exactly right. I mean, it's almost like this is the fuel that powers you in some sense. So like I'm at, you know, at any bookstore and I'm looking at, oh my God, this is a fantastic, you know, book that my marketing team would like. Or you're talking to somebody in the back of your mind, you're like, you know, I bet you this person would really love to hear what I have to tell them. Or even sometimes I need to connect this person to another entrepreneur friend of mine, you know, who probably has an idea that would be good for them. But you're right, you know, and it's just a different way of living.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if folks wanted to find out more information about MCN, how could they do so?
Oh, we have a fantastic website. It's www.mcn.com. And, you know, and you can absolutely get in touch with us, and we'd love to hear from you guys.
And we'll have that posted on our website as well, so people can just click on through.
All right. Well, Radhika, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Our next guest is Jesse Lindsley with Thrust Interactive. Jesse, when I came into the studio initially, you and I were talking a little bit about video games, and I dated myself by pointing out that I played video games back when vacuum tubes were popular.
Right.
But you've been in the video game business for a number of years now.
8 years. So we started in 2004. So Thrust as a company makes games for our clients. That's what we've been doing. We've made over 100 games, published over 100 games over that time. But in 2004, we started a company to go after the online gambling space.
Interesting.
I was a backgammon and dominoes player. My business partner was a gin and cribbage player, played spades. And every time we played, we would play for money. We'd play online, and you couldn't do that. Poker was taking off, and we thought, why can't we just play in that same field? So we launched, went out and raised money and launched a website, built it from scratch, a massive multiplayer browser-based gaming platform on which we were going to launch 20 of these skill games. And we did that for 2 years and went out to do a second round of funding, and the laws changed, which made it a decision where we had to decide if we wanted to stay in the United States or move. I had friends in the space that decided to move, and they don't need to work anymore, so I sometimes kick myself, but I decided to stay in the United States and get out of that space, and that's when we started making games for others. Mm. It's funny, the first work we did was with a virtual world called Barbie Girls. So my team went from doing gambling games to making a virtual doll game with the 8 to 12-year-old girls. It was the same kind of technology, massive multiplayer. Barbie Girls became the fastest-growing virtual world ever, 6 million signups in 4 months. And so that was kind of our entrance into building games for startups, building games for big brands, building all sorts of genres of games, focusing on web technologies.
And I assume the feds are less likely to show up at your doorstep with Barbie World versus...
That's right, yes. But I felt dirtier when I was chatting, doing our play testing with the 12-year-old girls than any time doing my offshore Costa Rican gambling, but whatever.
I love the show. the laws are changing back now, are they not?
No. I mean, they've been saying that for literally 8 years. So we'll see.
I've been a little bit plugged into this. It's a long story. We'll talk after. Okay. But I've been hearing that there is some ways around it now where you don't have to go offshore to do some skill games for money now. Is that...
It's always coming. It's always the new with this politician, with this new... this new government that's coming into place or whatever, the laws are changing.
And there's loopholes, I guess, and whatnot.
But that's always been there. I doubt it'll happen.
Yeah.
But you're even seeing organizations like Facebook saying they're going to get into the space, not for the U.S. facing customers, but the European facing customers. And we're doing something in that space. I literally have come full circle to where one of our largest projects right now is a is a gambling initiative on Facebook.
Interesting.
And so it's mostly virtual currency, and you can still monetize that way. Look at Zynga Poker. That's their most successful game. It's all, you know, I've got to pay money to get virtual chips, and I can never cash those virtual chips out. But there are rumors that the European version of Facebook at some point would allow me to cash in and cash out.
Well, aside from the poker app for Facebook, what else are you working on that you find interesting and exciting?
Yeah, we had a management meeting. We're working on, I think, 12 projects. We've got a team of 30 in Inman Park, and my COO was saying how none of the projects were the same, and it makes his jobs as making sure that we're running profitable projects and repeatable. So I know my team would like me to focus more. But what the underlying piece of everything we do is it's very interactive, it's very engaging, and usually there's some sort of game mechanic that is pushing what we're doing. So I'm sure you've heard about gamification, how people are literally giving badges and rewards using that kind of reward mechanism that are known in games for having you surf their website. We don't do that kind of stuff, but we find ourselves in educational training engagements and business apps. We're doing a really neat, innovative, what we're calling the Creativity Game Lab, an innovative platform for big ideas. We're good at doing this kinds of stuff because we understand engagement, we understand user experience, we understand cross-platform, how I go from the web to my mobile device that's with me all the time, and should this be a mobile-first or a web-first launch, and these kinds of things. So, it would be very hard to pigeonhole me to do one game genre. I'm passionate about games, I'm passionate about apps, and as long as I can justify those two things, then I feel like I'm staying true to my core competency, even though at again, 12 different projects. They're really all over the place. So to answer your question, we're doing a mobile app. It's a word and card game. It's iOS, Android, Windows 8. We're doing a touchscreen Windows Surface multiplayer game for kids. So it really does run the gamut of the types of things we're working on.
And the development that you're doing, is it typically paid development, or are you looking to have pull through, essentially be on app stores and finance the development via end user purchases?
So our company is a third party development company. So we are, it's paid contract work.
Okay.
So that's probably when we got into doing this and started our own company in 2004, we were generating our own revenue off our own IP. We've been building IP for others. At the beginning of 2011, I started finding myself with a little more breathing room. We had made it through some pretty lean times. I come across great ideas that maybe people can't afford our retail rate. I'm interested in the project. I'm interested in maybe some skin in the game. So my vision in the next 5 years is to where we would have 50% of our revenue coming from services and 50% coming from joint ventures or our own IP. And so we are at that point from a workload. We are working on joint ventures. We are working on our own IP. The revenue does not reflect that yet, but you've got to crawl before you can walk and before you can run. So I see that as some people, when they go from product into services and to survive, they'll find themselves wanting to get out of that. I love the services work we do. I never see us leaving that. I get to be around smart people. I get to be around big brands. I get to influence directions of larger budgets than I would ever have. It's fun to do a game for Mercedes that they don't have zero, no need to market it, and they get 200,000 downloads the first weekend. That's amazing to be a part of, and you challenge. There's different challenges versus the guy that comes to me with a wonderful idea, and if you build it, they will not come. And what's that go-to-market strategy? And so I enjoy working with folks that need a go-to-market strategy and folks that obviously do not, and have those customers just sitting there waiting for whatever they're going to drop. They'll purchase.
And you mentioned joint ventures as being a key strategy moving forward. What are you looking for in terms of a joint venture partner?
Yeah, it's a great question. If somebody wants me to put some skin in the game, they've got to be giving me the business case. They need to say, you know, they need to show me that they bring something to the table that I don't. And so I know people have a hard time, you know, when I sign these NDAs, they think they've come up with the next best thing. But ideas aren't worth jack shit, you know, kind of a thing. So it's all in the execution. And so I can handle the development. I can handle all kinds of strategy. But how are you going to take it to market? How are you going to, you know, bring the customers in? How are you going to manage what it is that we build? So I'm doing one with a huge, probably the biggest basketball celebrity. We're going to launch a game next for the beginning of the next NBA season. And I believe that he can bring the people to the game, you know, and so that's a joint venture I'm interested in. That's a brand that is a no-brainer for me. I will build that game and I will recoup my investment because I'm attached to that person.
So if you find a partner that can pull the demand through for you, you can take care of the product.
I get really excited.
Yeah.
Do you have situations where, I mean, in that scenario, the people will come to the game and they'll pay to play the game in some way, right? So that's where the money will come from, essentially. And because that person has a big name, they may have advertising on it and whatever else. But do you also find, like in the Mercedes example, that there are a lot of businesses out there that want games on their site just to keep people engaged on their site and get them coming back?
So I would say the majority of the games are like that. So at least the web-based, they're called Adver games. They're tools that engage. They're tools that mobilize. They're tools that, you know, I've got an ad team that's already selling, you know, sticky web experiences. If you can make it even stickier, I can add a sponsor to that and sell advertising, and there's my ROI.
Yeah.
Even if it's just purely market, I'm launching a show. We do lots of games for TBS and TNT where I'm just getting the word out. That's their ROI. But I have even big brands. We're doing something with another television station that the games have to make money. They have to, if I'm going to spend this much money on the game, I have to monetize it through in-app purchases, through premium versus, versus a free app that I'm monetizing through advertising. But part of my, you know, this great, I could come up with a great game design, but if it's not going to make money, they're not interested. So I have to show them this is how we're going to make money. And so what their end of the bargain is they have to bring the people in. If they bring in, you know, 1.2 million downloads and I retain 4% of them, I'm not going to do another game for them, I can guarantee you. They'll go search elsewhere.
Right.
One of the issues that we've heard a number of CEOs raise in terms of running software companies in the Atlanta marketplace is talent. And, you know, they find that it's a challenge quite often here to find and retain talent. What do you find in that space? What are you doing to develop talent, to identify talent?
Yeah, it's not a problem for me, but it's because that's what we do. It also doesn't hurt that I'm in the game business. I go to middle schools, and I did a career fair once where I was up on stage with a guy that was an accountant and a guy that was ran his own burial service, and I was getting all the questions, and they were like, this is rigged, you know. How
none of them wanted to be an undertaker.
exactly.
Come on, so, that sounds so fun.
That was the deck was stacked in my favor. So I do have that going for me. I'd say the other thing is very involved in the community. So when I started the game company, there were 6, I think, in Atlanta. Now there are 70. I've been a big part of that. I run all the local user groups. I host meetups. I run the International Game Developers Association chapter. I go speak at middle schools and colleges, so I am finding the talent. I'm getting the cream of the crop. What we always had trouble with was being able to hire people right out of school. So I'd say for the first 6 years, we didn't hire a single recent college graduate. And I felt guilty about it. But it was because we were doing big budget client demanding work, and somebody out of school just couldn't come in and help and have an impact. In 2010, when we launched our lab, we started again going back to doing our own products and doing things that were innovative, where we could do the launch an intern program. And now we have a very, very successful internship program where we are incubating talent. I think I hired 50% of the 30 interns we've had since we started it in 3 years. So that's a pretty good track record. The rest of the people finding them jobs and them saying a big part of them finding a job was because of the work they did at Thrust. It's been very rewarding, and I'm pretty proud of that program.
Well, I think, you know, one of the nice things about bringing someone in straight out of school as well is you can say to them, this is how it's done. You know, mm-hmm. this is the way that one gets things done.
Right. If you're dealing with people like Micah and I, we won't bend. We can't be taught.
Just obstinate.
Right. We're just stubborn and yeah.
All right. Well, Jesse, the same question that we asked Radhika, for you, being an entrepreneur is disruptive. How do you deal with that disruption in your daily life?
Yeah. Well, I love what I do. So I didn't find it that disruptive. I think it didn't hurt that I was single and I didn't need much of anything to do much of anything. I have a 7-month-old daughter. I have a wife now. Things are a little different.
Got a 4-month-old. I hear you.
So they expect me to make a certain amount of money and provide certain things like a house and these crazy things like a car. And so I've had to buckle down, and it's given me all kinds of focus. I can't just be focused on growth. I have to be focused on profitability. I don't want to miss out on my daughter growing up either, so I need to find that balance.
Well, at least now you know how to play Barbies with her.
I do.
This is a key question for me. My daughter's 4 months old. When can I expect to sleep through the night?
This is how I make a lot of enemies. My daughter started sleeping through the night at 6 weeks.
Wow.
All right. Well, thanks very much, yeah. Jesse.
Thanks for being on the show.
Then I guess my interview is going to be shorter because she started at 4 weeks.
She started.
We've been very spoiled. 9 to 9.
Oh, that's excellent.
My daughter is 20 years old and she still doesn't sleep through the night.
but that doesn't keep.
It's a whole different reason though now.
Well, Jesse, if folks have more questions or wants more information on Thrust Interactive, how can they find out more information about your firm?
It's thrustinteractive.com. It's Jesse at Thrust Interactive. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. It's easy to find me.
All right, great. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, the next guest that we've got is Kobe Margolin.
Yes.
You did better than did I did.
Did I get that? Did I put the emphasis on the? All right,
thank
excellent.
You,
I mean, Radhika's probably never going to speak to me again.
Oh, never.
And Kobe is the CEO of Clinigence. Kobe, tell us just a bit about Clinigence and what it does.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, we are right at the intersection of big data and healthcare.
Okay.
Radhika, thank you so much. You laid the groundwork by introducing the big data portion of what we do. And I think what's left for me is really to put it in the context of healthcare. Everybody pretty much knows that our healthcare system is in the midst of some major, major transformation, revolution. Call it health reform, call it Obamacare, call it what you like. It's big. We play right into that. We believe that in that transformation, data, big data, has a very, very critical role to play. There was a study a year ago from one of the major market research firms around different industries and the way that big data now can revolutionize them. And one of the sections that they dedicated was healthcare in the U.S. And they estimated that big data in healthcare can save this country $330 billion per year.
Wow.
The conservative estimates about our healthcare systems today, and if you compare our healthcare system to any other nation, any other developed nation, is that we have about $750 billion of waste in our healthcare system every year.
Well, my understanding is we're spending about 18% of GDP on healthcare in this country, and the OECD average is something like 8%.
Yeah, we're about twice as any other country. I'm semi-Americanized. I came here from Israel about 12, 13 years ago. A couple of years ago, with the American Israeli Chamber of Commerce in town, we did a business exchange where we brought Israeli companies, healthcare IT, to match them up with U.S. corporations. And we looked at the two healthcare systems, and it turned out, and this should be shocking to anybody who listens to it, that Israel pays on a per capita basis less than half of what we spend here in the U.S. for healthcare. And then when you look at the, take life expectancy as one macro quality indicator, Israel is not the easiest place to live in, we all know, and yet life expectancy there is about a year longer than here in the U.S. So what do we get for all this money that we're paying for healthcare?
Well, I know one of the big changes that's happened is we're shifting from pay-per-service to pay-per-outcome.
Exactly.
And my guess is the analysis of the clinical data can really help healthcare providers shift to that model or maintain profitability in shifting to that model. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think you started with Radhika on the question of what is the bigger challenge? Is it the data, getting the data, or the analysis, the analytics of the data, and now throwing her answer into healthcare, well, we have a huge challenge still in this country around the acquisition of the data, around the extraction of the data, even just collecting data. We all know when we go to our physician offices, we see filing cabinets full of patient charts that are still on paper. Until recently, I mean, the vast majority of data was still on paper. We have one section, interestingly enough, that has gone electronic in the past decade or so, but that's just the billing side of data. And we created, especially in this town, there's been a lot of innovation around revenue cycle management, making sure that the billing data in healthcare flows electronically. But when it comes to the clinical piece of it, to the real patient data, nobody has touched it. To me, that's entirely crazy. We've wasted billions of dollars on building a very sophisticated billing system, but we have no idea what's going on with patient outcomes, with the clinical piece of it. Well, that is changing, and the reason we do what we're doing is because over the past few years, certainly a big drive for that was around Obamacare and health reform. The government is putting a lot of billions and billions of dollars into digitizing our healthcare system on the clinical side, making sure that healthcare providers use electronic medical records so that data can then be mined, analyzed, used. And we jumped into all of this and help clients after they go through the adoption of electronic medical records exactly with making sense of the data, the clinical piece of the data, so that now we can generate an alignment where you're really driving patient outcomes. So we play to the shift in the payment models from fee-for-service, where you really didn't need to know anything about the quality of the services or
you
the patient
to know
outcomes.
What the insurance company would reimburse you at.
Exactly.
Not, right.
Exactly. Now, with the shift towards value-based payment, suddenly, for the first time, everybody is interested. Everybody has a need to know what's going on, really, with the quality of care, with the efficiency of care, and then, most importantly, with the outcomes of care.
I noticed on your website that some of your clients are small physicians groups. Is there enough data in a small physicians group to mine and analyze for clinical outcomes?
Well, you know, we looked pretty closely. We think that big data has a role to play throughout the healthcare system, and certainly the revolution is starting now with healthcare providers, which include hospitals and physicians and other ancillary providers. We chose to go in the path less traveled of going after the physicians, the physician practices, and even more specifically, today, the vast majority of our customers are in primary care because we think that there lies the best potential for actually starting the revolution in the care delivery system. And the reason for that is you look at the amount of data. Well, think about it a little bit differently. Your family doctor probably knows about you way more than any specialist or any hospital that you've ever visited. And that is the key, one of the maybe two keys in our strategic decision to at least initially go after that segment of the market. So number one, they have the continuity, the continuum of care, as we call it. They see through major episodes in your care. We have a very difficult challenge in our healthcare system where everything has been episodic, whereas healthcare is something that happens throughout your life. Much of it happens in between visits to any healthcare provider. Who monitors that? Who keeps an eye on what's going on? So we think that family doctors, primary care physicians actually have a unique and critical role to play in all of this. The second piece, I think that there is still a bond of trust that exists today between patients and their primary care family doctors that is stronger and can be leveraged than with an emergency room doctor that you see when, you know, you happen to get to the emergency room. You don't know them clearly. I mean, yes, you trust that, you know, that they have the credentials, but you don't really know them. And at the end of the day, the key thing to reforming our healthcare system is behavior change. The ultimate goal is to get to the patient and get the patient, get all of us, us as consumers, to become more involved, more engaged in our own healthcare. Today, unfortunately, and I think it's our own creation, and so we can recreate it, we can fix it. For the most part, the consumer is disengaged, uninterested in their own healthcare. And we've created a payment system that creates that perpetuates that. But with the changes, how do we get to the consumer? How do we get people engaged in their own healthcare? We think that physicians, providers, it's like we have an army out there that can really reach out to the masses of consumers. But first, we need to change the behavior of the physicians.
Well, you know, you made a really good point, and I've not thought about it from this perspective before, but the idea of going from sort of episodic monitoring on an exception basis to looking at things as a continuum is really an interesting thing to be able to do, because you can then point to cause and effect for the consumer.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
You look at it episodically, and it's like the data is in silos, as Radhika said earlier, and you miss the whole point. You know, you're not looking where the answer lies. And I completely also agree with Radhika that the big value will not come from putting in hypothesis, but rather from looking at all of the data without hypothesis and then mining it to find new insights for finding answers to questions that nobody has ever asked because they didn't know to ask it.
Right. It's Radhika, as you said earlier, it's sort of being able to pull back and take a look at, well, here are the mountains, here's the lake, here's the terrain overall.
Exactly. You know, and I agree with so many points that Kobe's actually made. But, you know, I mean, at this point, I have to also kind of tell you that, you know, one of the issues around this big data has been so much time and effort has been wasted in taking the data, putting it into tables in databases. And it's almost useless once you do that, right? And he's smiling over there because, I mean, it's almost like databases paralyze you. So we're working with companies where we just say, guys, let's just take it in the native format. Let the data start organizing itself, because most of data is unstructured. Very small part of it is structured. Just like he said, I mean, these doctors who write all this
right.
stuff.
Can't read to begin with, let alone digitize it.
It's like Twitter in a handwriting,
right?
So you want the data to start organizing itself, and then you want it to emerge to say, wait, women who live in, you know, within cities, there is an interaction over here, or maybe it's the water, or maybe women between, you know, 30 and 40, this is what's happening to them. You want the data to start speaking back to you.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure.
It's very interesting. And Radhika, I think we'll have interesting conversations after this. I had lunch yesterday with the chief medical information officer of a large hospital here in the state, and he was talking about how the move to electronic medical records and the capture of data electronically has caused physicians to lose the art of the story in their notes. And there is a big conflict right now around two trends, one of which is the need to get more structured data for reasons that anybody in data understands very, very well. And then the difficulties of taking something that is based on a narrative and putting it into a structured format. And I think if we could find ways to bridge that, that is going to be extremely powerful, because physicians are resistant to that switch. It's different than the way they used to do things. And they still, unfortunately in healthcare, you know, we're still dealing with, it's much easier for me to write. I mean, it takes 2 seconds. And then if I read it, I know it. I get the story. But when it's in database tables, I'm lost. It takes me more time. There was, by the way, just the other day, a story in New York Times around one of the unintended effects of electronic medical records that talked about the potential for maybe fraud and abuse in the use of electronic medical records. The fact of the matter is, when you listen to physicians, oftentimes it's not fraud and abuse. They're just trying to figure out a way to use these new systems. And in the process, they do things that are unintentional and cause other effects that seem to be almost in the area of fraud and abuse.
Have the Fed showing up at their doorstep much like they did with Jesse back when he was doing poker?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the interesting aspects of it, obviously when you're looking at big data and you're looking at healthcare, you're talking at some level about pulling that data together, as you said, to find trends and maybe answer questions that might actually help with disease prevention or whatever down the road. But I also think there's the backward side of that, which I think really speaks to your decision to work with primary care physicians, because of healthcare and the way it's been for the last however many years, I think we've lost that traditional doctor who does actually know us. And, you know, when they hand write that note and your chart ends up being 20 or 30 pages and they stick that thing on the outside of the door before they come in to talk to you, they come in and I've experienced that, we all have, I'm sure. And they're trying to read through it in the 2 seconds before when they picked it up off the door and when they walk in the room. And really all they're getting is maybe what they put on the last visit, whenever that was. But it's almost like with that data, if they had it, you know, and they were able to mine it properly, that front sheet could actually be a summary of the last 10 years with just the highlights, so that when they walk in the room, they're seeing the important things that happened to you over the last 10 years instead of just what they hand wrote in one visit.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a great need for visualization of data, because I think the way that this conflict is going to go about, there is no doubt that we need to collect the data electronically and we need the structured data, because the value that we can get out of it over time, we can simply as a country not ignore it, not just in terms of more efficient healthcare system, but even maybe more importantly, at the end of the day, our ability to accelerate medical knowledge through the data that we now collect. At the same time, we need to keep the art of medicine going. And so figuring out a way to take the combination of the structured data and the insights that come from the structured data and then visualizing that for a physician so that at the end of the day, yes, they will have to go through a technology adoption curve, but they will see the benefits of the technology and say, you know what, it's worth it because this is even better than where we started. And I think we will get there. In healthcare, technology lags behind other industries. I've always found in my career, this is my third venture in healthcare IT, that this always represents opportunities to disrupt healthcare simply by bringing lessons learned from other industry into healthcare. And then you can always make a big impact.
You know, Dana, I'd like to follow up on what you said. I totally believe that, you know, the impact of big data is going to go from large organizations, Micah, the way you talked, all the way down to the individual physicians, right? So I think I almost feel like we're going to have kind of a two hump, you know, bubble with this big data revolution. The first is where it's around the large organizations, whether it's large financial institutions, large healthcare institutions, insurance. And then once they absorb it, then it's going to move on to the B2C realm, which is the smaller players. So I think it's a tremendous revolution and the impact on the country is going to be phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes total sense that everything starts that way. You know, computers weren't initially for us and look at us now.
Right.
So.
Well, Kobe, we've got just a few minutes left and I don't want to give short shrift to your company. So tell us a bit about who Clinigence clients are. We talked a bit about that, and also tell us what makes your technology unique.
Yeah, so we have kind of a dual approach to the market. We go after ambulatory, private practices, medical physician practices, with an eye on primary care, and we do that by engaging channel partners. I mentioned electronic medical records. What we do is really complement or add on value to their products, and therefore they're the perfect channel partners for us. We've so far signed up two of those and are targeting the. It's still a very fragmented market with dozens and even hundreds of vendors in
it. Are they practice management groups? Are they technology channel partners that you're working with?
Yes. Okay. So those are technology channel partners.
Okay.
And then we are also targeting, there is a portion of Obamacare called accountable care or accountable care organization. People are familiar more with the consumer-facing pieces of Obamacare, the insurance pieces of it. But then behind it, there is an attempt to completely revolutionize the care delivery system. And one of the ways they're doing that by really shifting payment is through this concept of accountable care organization. There are today about 100 of those that are Medicare government-based, about 200 or 300 altogether, and many more are coming. So this is an emerging market. And the old concept is a group of providers, healthcare providers, take responsibility and start taking risk. We are targeting those. We've just signed the first one, one that is actually primary care driven. So it's the physicians who are in the driver's seat of, in an accountable care organization, figuring out how to deliver care that's more effective and efficient, and what we become under those circumstances. And in that sense, really, we are unique, is we are like a navigation system for the person, the physician, in the driver's seat to figure out where to go. And the analogy kind of breaks because we are looking at a terrain where the roads have not been determined yet, have not been paved yet. So we are giving them a way, like maybe in geocaching, for those who are familiar with it, to go off the road and see where they are and start paving the roads. And we think that those accountable care organizations will be the early adopters that pave the roads, so then the masses can go through and with that take our healthcare system altogether over the chasm, which is an interesting kind of way to think about things because of the chasm of technology adoption.
Sure, sure.
Wow.
All right, well, that was certainly an interesting overview from several different fields.
Yeah,
I feel like we've gotten just an overload of information here in terms of changes that are going on.
We did. I learned a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
My brain kind of hurts.
Okay, so to put it into a little bit of a milder, funnier, I'd say that...
Dumb it down for us.
I have a 2.5-year-old, and Clinigence is about the same age. And I wrote a blog when they were both around a year old, and I said, those are my twins.
Nice.
And we absolutely didn't want to have twins. And I found myself with twins, and literally that's the way I've thought about it and felt. And is it easy? Well, ask anybody who had twins, is it easy?
Sure, sure.
And as an entrepreneur, I'm not familiar with this whole healthcare thing, so, or going to a hospital or whatever. So I've learned something today.
That's right. We all did.
Yeah, but Jesse, you do gaming. That sounds like a lot of fun. And the amount of data that gaming generates,
oh, yeah,
unbelievable. So imagine, like, one of the telco carriers we were talking to has all this gaming data along with the mobile data that they're looking at to see what kind of games you play, when, where, and the location base, so they can give you rewards based on where you are. So it all ties back.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. The gaming approach can drive the behavior that ultimately the clinical research indicates should be driven, perhaps.
Yeah, of course. I was also thinking, as you were talking, like, what kind of games could you use to kind of get physicians more comfortable with using technology? I mean, there's so many ways to kind of combine what you're all doing.
Pancreas attack or...
Yeah.
And I want to thank Jesse because I've been struggling with the question of people from fresh out of school. And I've felt guilty about not, this was, we are at Georgia Tech, we're part of the incubator there. And I think you answered my question, why this has not worked out as well as I expected. And I've not given up on it by any stretch.
All right. Well, I think that about wraps it up. We got contact information from everybody. Did you give your website for Clinigence?
So, so you can certainly read more about us at www.clinigence.com.
Awesome. This has been great, really informative. I know, my brain is hurting. I got a lot to, I'm going to have to listen to it again so I can process all of this. But as always, I want to thank our sponsor, Minerva Planning Group, the good folks who provide their clients with financial peace of mind. Check them out online at MinervaPlanningGroup.com. This has been Disruptive Business Radio for Micah Porter and myself. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.